Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. Gosh, this will be the fourth or fifth time I've seen Lyle tell his story. He was here 3 years ago, celebrated his 21st birthday. It was purely a coincidence that we scheduled on that night. And so that was a big night like this one. Today, Lyle's got 24 years. The first time I saw him speak was at Atlanta Men's Workshop, and he was the other speaker, major speaker, was Sandy Beach. Both Marine pilots, and they had such a warm regard for each other. I really saw how Lyle really took care of Sandy and looked up to him. Anyway, he touched me, and I'm sure his story will touch you. If you have to be somewhere at 9 o'clock, no offense, just try to be as quiet as you can and leave. Lyle's story goes a little longer than most. If you want to hear the real story, stick around. Lyle, please come up and join us.
Good evening, folks. My name is Lyle, and I'm an alcoholic. I carry a timer, and all of a sudden it's malfunctioning. And I see the clock back there, so we should be out of here by 10 at least. And anyway, thanks for letting me be part of your evening. I'm up here to tell a story. I'm not up here to watch the clock, and that's what I'm going to do. I understand, you know, if somebody has to leave here at 9 o'clock, that's fine with me. I have no problem with that. It's just that I've been some places where the clock really becomes more important than the message, and I don't go there. As a matter of fact, just had an exchange with some folks out on the West Coast, and it's real important that they get out of there by 9 o'clock and they hold these signs up, 15 to go, 10 to go, 5 to go. I said, you know, I really don't need that. Well, it's not that my message is so very important. It's not that at all. It's just that if my first priority is the clock, then I should have just stayed home. I really just should have stayed home. This is about sobriety and recovery, and that's really what I'm about, and that's what I came to hear when I was brand new. That's what I needed to hear. The other thing is, I never drank that punctual, you know, like, I was never that punctual. Nobody ever came into the bar and said, you got 15 minutes to go, so hustle up. When I went into a bar, I was better off to just take a calendar with me instead of a clock. So I'm thinking, how do we get from there to here? So I'll do what I can in the time that I've got, and I'll correct this timer when I get home. And there are times when I look down at it and go, God darn, I haven't even gone to prison yet. I better hustle up here. I've been here before, not for a while. It's always kind of a homecoming to come here and to see the NABA folks. It's just such an incredible facility. And Tim was talking about Sandy and I. And Sandy was one of my heroes long before I met him. I'd heard about him. And I met him maybe 10 or 12 years ago. He's still one of my heroes. He's a bigger hero today than he was even when I was listening to his tapes and his CDs before I met him. And he's an incredibly wonderful, great example of Alcoholics Anonymous and recovery. I used to want to be like him, and I've given that up. I thought sooner or later, as the years roll by, I would just kind of meld into something like that, and I've learned that that's not going to happen. That I'm me, Sandy is Sandy, and I'm content at this point just to leave it at that and keep trying to do what I'm supposed to do. My sobriety date is March the 7th of 1990. It was a big day. The event that I'm going to talk about made national and international news. Then so when I got to treatment, which was one day later, and people were doing this thing like they do when you show up, and it's all well-intentioned and good-natured, like, well, we've been waiting for you, or, you know, and if you can't remember your last drunk, maybe you haven't had it, and I think, Jesus, I got Tom Brokaw and Peter Jennings and everybody talking about mine. I don't think it's going to be a problem in the future. It hasn't been. There are 3 days that transpired there that I usually hearken back to, and they're just intense every year when they come around, and I'm grateful for the intensity of that. I don't want to forget any of those. And I can look at my watch on those days, any of the three, and I know what was happening and where I was and what was taking place. And it's a good reminder to me of why I get sober, stay sober, and want to keep doing this deal. On March the 7th, I was in Fargo, North Dakota, and I was just doing what I normally did. I was just out having a good time, having some drinks. I had no idea that was going to be the date of my last series of drinks, at least up to this point. The next morning, March the 8th, was the day that everything occurred, and there was an airline flight from Fargo, North Dakota, landing at the Twin Cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul. And when they landed, that entire airline crew was arrested, the first time in history that had occurred, and I was the captain of that flight crew. typically, you know, I always talk about when we come to the podium, we don't talk about what we did. A lot, most of the time, the speakers come and go. I don't know who they were, what their profession was, or because it's not part of the recovery story. So when I talk about this airline pilot stuff, it's in the context of the story only. It was the thing that really drove this. If I had been anything other than an airline pilot, none of the outfall or the publicity would have occurred. It just wouldn't have taken place. I mean, if I had been a doctor, an attorney, an electrician, a plumber, a construction worker, an office worker, nothing would have taken place. But because I was an airline pilot, this thing hit the news media, and I mean, it stayed on for weeks and months. I didn't think it would ever go away. There's been a number of incidents happen since then, and you'll see them on the news periodically. Somebody gets picked up going through TSA or whatever, and their name or face might be in the news that night, and then you don't see it the next day. This has become kind of an old hat thing. But I was the first airline pilot that this ever occurred to, and I tell you what, they latched onto that and stayed with it for a long time. I had times when I thought, I'm not even sure Pearl Harbor got this much coverage. And it just... And it just stayed on, and it was just a source of horror and devastation for me, because that wasn't what I was about. Over the course of the years, I get to hear a lot of speakers and a lot of stories. And it occurred to me not long ago that for a newcomer who's coming into this fellowship or who is scoping it out, our stories are so diverse. They are all over the place, as are our drinking patterns, and the things that happened to us and the way that we went about it. I thought, you know, if I was a newcomer and I'm sitting there and I'm looking for reasons why I don't belong, I'll find plenty of them. I'll find plenty. Because I can sit there and go, I didn't do that. That never happened to me. As a matter of fact, I used that for a long time when I was trying to kind of take a look once in a while when I might get mildly concerned about my drinking. And so I would devise a test, which most normal drinkers don't feel compelled to do. But I would devise a test based totally on zero knowledge of alcoholism. But I told one of the other pilots that I was talking with here the other day, I said, "But that's part of the pilot thing. You know, we don't have to know anything about anything to be a real authority on it." And so I would come up with these tests, and I would always pass them, and... I looked back later when I got into treatment and I thought, I don't know how anybody can be that so grossly ignorant and blind about all of this. But I know that that's part of the deal. So if I'm new and I want to make sure that I don't belong here, I just listen to some of the stories. I never did any of that stuff. Or I didn't do that. And I didn't. So I'm different. I hear the stories and I identify with every one of them. Facts and circumstances vary. Some are more exciting than others. But what I listen for, and it doesn't make any difference if it's male, female, young, old, black, white, red, yellow, doesn't make any difference to me, because what I listen for is what this disease does. And no matter how it occurs, and no matter how what the experiences of the storyteller are, I identify with them. Because I hear about the loss and the shame and the anguish and the pain and the devastation, the horror. And then I listen for what recovery does, for what Alcoholics Anonymous does when we finally put our arms around this thing. And I listen for the upswing. And I always see it and hear it, and so I always identify with those stories. When I walked off the airplane that morning, I saw airport policemen, two of them. I saw FAA officials, a bunch of them. And I saw Northwest Airlines officials, a number of those guys. And I already knew how this story was going to end. I knew what was going to happen because I'd seen it before. I never, ever, ever, ever thought I would be at the center of something like this. Northwest was the only major carrier at that time that did not have a program for alcoholic pilots. All the other major carriers had those programs, and they were incredibly, amazingly successful. Not because they're dealing with pilots, but because it is a long-term, long-time, heavily accountable process with chief pilots involved, doctors involved, peer monitors involved, a lot of monitoring, a lot of random tests, a lot of everything that over the course of 3 years proves quite successful. And Northwest had chosen not to be part of that community. And so every now and then I saw a pilot get in difficulty, and if that difficulty reached the company's attention, the outcome was always the same. It was a very swift, severe, irrevocable termination. They left, they never came back, and the rest of us knew their names. Those stories swept the airline like wildfire, and we heard about them immediately. And so I knew the names, and I knew a lot of the details as best they had been related in the locales where they had occurred. And over the millions of thoughts that I had that day of the arrest, for the 12 hours that we were detained, one of the thoughts that I had that was just crippling was, that's my legacy. That's where my name goes. And that's how I leave this airline. That's how I'll be remembered. And that was devastating. That was just devastating. I had, from the moment I walked off the airplane, the first instant feeling I had was one of absolute, total, penetrating shame and disgrace and dishonor. I mean, it was instant. Later, as I look back, I wondered why it was so crippling to me. And I think it was because I hadn't lived my life like that. That wasn't who I was. It wasn't what I was supposed to do. It wasn't who I was supposed to be. I had been the guy in my family who had raised three children who were grown and gone, and I was the standard bearer for things like duty, honor, country, character, honesty, integrity, do the right thing. And suddenly, in the aftermath of this, all of the things that I thought I had tried to teach and talk about were very hollow and meaningless. And, of course, that became even more evident as the days unwound and I became a national disgrace. I'm the guy that they were making the jokes about. And I have a real empathy today for things like that, and I don't find them funny. I don't condemn those who think that the Tiger Woods jokes are funny or any of the other stuff. That's your business. But I know what that feels like on a personal level. I know that Jay Leno made his career on me for a long time. And when I would see and hear those jokes, it was like somebody just stuck a red-hot knife right through my belly. I mean, it hurt. And so I have great empathy for that those situations. And I just ask people, please don't send them to me anymore. You're free to enjoy them at your leisure, but I'm just not one of that crowd. We were taken to two different places, and we gave blood. At the second place, there was a reporter who saw uniformed pilots and uniformed cops, and that's how the story broke to the public. I had no idea that was going to occur. The fact that it was going to sweep Northwest Airlines was by itself absolutely devastating to me, more than I thought I could handle. I had no idea this was going to go all around the world. We were deposed by the company attorneys. I gave a sworn statement, and we were finally released. Now, I had many surreal moments that day. I couldn't believe this was happening to me. There were times when I felt like I was suspended someplace out of my present. I was watching this. I was watching this happen to somebody, and then I was having those reality moments, and I thought, this is happening to me, and it's happening right now. I got home, or I got back to a commuter apartment after that day was over, and I called my wife. I'd forgotten that I was supposed to be home that evening out here at the Atlanta airport. She waited for 4 hours, and she was not yet home when the answering machine picked up, and I didn't know what to say. I left a very whispered message that there'd been a disaster. I thought I'd lost my job. I'd be in the first flight the next morning, and I don't know why she didn't call me back. Later, I looked at that, and I thought, God, what a gift that was. I was so sick, I just didn't want to talk about this. I couldn't talk about it. I don't know why she didn't call me back. Next morning, I got home on the first flight, exited the airport very quickly. I knew a lot of people. I didn't want anybody to speak to me, see me, stop me, or anything. And I got to the front of the airport, and I looked, and she was parked out to my right, out by the curb. And I've never told a story of what I didn't say. I had walked over and got in the car, and I felt like I had to climb over the curb to get in the car with her. And she and I had been married for a good long while at this point, and I couldn't look at her. The shame was so great I could not even look at my wife, and she pulled away from the curb. All I could say is, honey, I'm so sorry. She has a very soft voice, South Texas accent. All she said to me was, who better than I could possibly understand how you might feel right now? We drove home in silence. Again, another gift that I didn't recognize until some time later, when it occurred to me, what wife, having learned that her husband had just trashed a 22-year golden career as an airline captain, would not have said, why did you stay? You've seen this before. You knew the Northwest policy. Why didn't you go back to your hotel room? She had a right to every one of those questions. And I was surprised later that she didn't ask those. I didn't have an answer for any of them. We got back to the house. She went to work, and I could not stay still in my own skin. I just didn't want to be in my skin. And a few minutes later, I walked over and picked the phone up and I called a doctor. He's a PhD doctor, family therapist, who gets into the story here in a little while. I didn't know who else to call. And I said I needed to declare an emergency. And I said, something bad has really happened. He said, come right straight over. I'll clear the calendar. So I went over to his office, and I can still see it just like it happened 5 minutes ago. I walked in. This is now Friday, March the 9th. And I was going to hear two things that day, two statements that I could not mentally process, and I heard the first one shortly after I walked in the office because I told him straight out what had happened. The good thing about this, folks, was that this was my final blow. This took it all away from me. The destruction was so complete that I didn't have any desire or ability to deny, try to make up answers, minimize, make excuses. I didn't have any. It was just gone. And so I told him straight out what had happened. And he looked at me and he said, God, Lyle, he said, this is horrible. And he was stunned. And he started across, started around his desk, and he stopped and he looked at me, and I heard the first statement that day that I could not fathom. And he said, but maybe this is what had to happen. I had no earthly idea why he would say that to me. I didn't know how that fit into anything. I couldn't respond, didn't respond. He left and he came back a little while later and he said, there's another doctor I want you to see tonight. He said, he's across Atlanta on the other side, but he said he's a very prominent doctor. He's a psychiatrist. He's a recovering alcoholic and cocaine addict, and he's certified in addiction medicine. And I had never, ever heard of addiction medicine. I had no idea what that was. And I did pick up on the 6 o'clock appointment on a Friday night, though. I picked up on that. That conveyed a certain sense of urgency. I knew that. Later, he told me, he said, based on your appearance, he said, I was so afraid you were a suicide that it was imperative that I get you over there to see this man as quickly as possible. And I thought to myself, I have no idea what I looked or sounded like, but I can tell you those dark thoughts were already starting to creep into the far crevices of my mind. I was already starting to have those thoughts. Barbara and I followed a set of directions and went over there to see this man. Now, I hadn't had anything to eat or drink for 2 days, the day before the arrest nor all day Friday. And I have absolutely no memory of that meeting. It's just like a blackout, and I've had lots of those. I know I was there, and I know that we went into a room. Barbara waited outside, and I know that I told him exactly what happened. I know that I was as honest as I had the capacity to be. At some point in our meeting, and I have no idea how long that might have been, he said to me, he said, Lyle, you're an alcoholic, and you need to get into treatment tonight. The other thing that struck me was that I had no reaction to that, because I've hated alcoholics all my life. I've hated alcoholics. My parents are alcoholics. They were. They died from this disease. I saw what happened to the family. I saw it in the native community that I grew up in. I saw those people. I saw it in the towns and the cities around the United States when I flew. And I see these people laying in the alleys and the doorways, dirty, brown paper bags, sometimes on a park bench, sometimes laying on the grass in the park, drunk, passed out. Those were alcoholics. That was my picture of an alcoholic, and I didn't fit that picture. But I knew when he told me I was an alcoholic, I knew I was. I'll never understand how in that 24-hour period from the time of the arrest, in some way, some form or fashion that I will never understand, way down inside, somehow, some way, those dots got connected, and I knew that I was that one thing I swore I would never be, that I hated so much, that even though I didn't behave and drink like my parents did, I was an alcoholic just like they were, just like the people I had seen around the country. And I said to him, I thought you'd tell me that, and I'm okay with it. And I said, I just got home today. And I said, please, let me go home. I said, I'd like for Barbara just to hang on to me. Let my mind uncoil. Let me just absorb what's happened to me. And then I'll go to treatment. And he said, you need to get into treatment tonight. And I paused and took a breath and looked at him. I said, okay. Our first lesson of willingness, I guess. So we left his office following another set of instructions back across Atlanta to a treatment center that was 2.5 miles from the Atlanta airport called Anchor Hospital. Never heard of it. Had no reason to know anything about it. So we made the final turn there, and the headlights hit a sign, and I hit the brakes with those lights on the sign right in front of me. There's a reason, I think, why we do some of our written work. When we see it on the pages, when we see the words, when we see this thing, these things we've laid out, they become real. They're not just floating through my mind anymore. They're very real, and they're in front of me, just like that sign was. And it said Anchor Hospital, a hospital for alcoholism and other chemical dependencies. And I just sat there, aghast, destroyed, thinking, my God Almighty, how does my life end like this? In a treatment center for alcoholics, the last place on the planet I thought I would ever see. And I just sat there. And I had a little brief mini flashback of some of the really neat moments in my life. And these things just, it takes me much longer to talk about them than it does for them to occur. This the thing just swept through my mind of these images of some of my accomplishments and my trophy moments, most of them against the odds. And these were the things that had really elevated me and given me a reputation and allowed me to be somebody. And I wasn't even sure at that moment that it ever occurred or existed. And it was like some kind of giant eraser just wiped them out and they were gone. And I remember sitting there completely empty, devoid of any sense of self-worth as a human being. I was a zero, had no value. Later I read a report, summarizing paragraph at the end of a long report one of the doctors had made after my treatment. He said, given the history and background of this man, it was unlikely to believe he would ever be a productive member of society. And I remember kind of looking at that and flinching a little bit. I thought, God, how'd they come to that? That's a pretty dismal conclusion. And a second thought was, I was the one that gave him all the information. So, we started down the hill into the treatment center. Dark. My life was over. I knew it was over. And for the first time that day, it occurred to me, this is March the 9th. This is my 27th wedding anniversary. One day after the arrest, and I'm going into a treatment center on my 27th wedding anniversary. And I said in a very defeated way, hell of a way to spend an anniversary, huh? I then heard the second statement that I could not respond to. Barbara very softly said, might be the best one we ever had. I thought, who could think that? My life is so far beyond repair. I will never come back from this, ever. Who could manufacture a thought like that in a moment like this? And I didn't respond. I usually stop here and kind of bounce back and lighten it up a little bit and tell you a few years ago, March the 9th rolled around, and I live with a long, winding driveway, kind of out by myself, and up pulls one of my sponsees. It was 9 a.m. in the morning. It was a beautiful Georgia morning, clear blue skies, temperature was nice, gorgeous day, and I said, what are you doing here? He said, I've heard the story. I know it's your anniversary. I just wanted to come by and wish you a happy anniversary. I said, well, come on in. So we went inside, and we're laughing, and things are light and cheery and breezy, and he says, well, what's the secret to having stayed married so long? And I didn't get a chance to say anything. Barbara said, mostly due to the fact that I could never stand to admit I made a mistake. And that's her story, and she's sticking to it. So yeah. I've always thought it's a little dangerous for us to let our spouses know that this is an ego-deflating program, because some of them take it real serious. I was born in Wichita, Kansas in September of 1938, so I'm 75 and a half. I have a problem with the age, except it's a big number. It got here awfully fast, and I feel about half that old. I have great health, and I usually get the age thing out of the way because I sit in the audience, and I'm always trying to figure out how old the speakers are. And usually by the time they're done, I've got it figured out because they drop little hints along the way. Notice, though, that the AA speaker gals are the most difficult. I don't know if that's by design, intent, gender, or what. But they'll come up and they'll say something like, I graduated from college, and so I'm thinking, well, actually, it was 21 or 22. She'll say, the same year that Kennedy was assassinated. I'm going, Jesus, I was 63, I think. So subtract back out of that. Or I had my first child when I was 25, and it was 2 years after Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. I'm going, 68 or 69. So I'm adding, subtracting, crediting, debiting, and by the time she walks off, I'm thinking, I have no idea. She's either 43 or 68. So I just get this thing out of the way so we can all move along. You know, I'm so grateful that I'm healthy. Most of my friends have got knee replacements, hip replacements, back operations, neck operations, or parts that are medicated. And I've always said, you know, I got all my parts and they all work, which is Barb's cue to say, well, most of the time. And that's something. I grew up in a World War II housing project on the southeast edge of Wichita, Kansas, called Plainview. Not a very pretty place. It was where the economically depressed folks lived, but I tell you, those are some of the happiest memories I'll ever have. Great, great childhood. We were all the same. And it was in the 50s, literally happy days. We didn't have any gangs, drive-by shootings. Drugs were almost unheard of. Nobody knew much about drugs. I didn't know anybody that did drugs. No classroom incidents. It was a very diverse community, blacks, whites, Hispanics, and a small Native American segment, and everybody got along. I don't remember hearing about any trouble more than a couple of times that entire time. This is an economically depressed area where people are out there that don't have a whole lot, uneducated for the most part, economically deprived, and yet we all got along. Everybody got along. And I was part of the Native American segment. I'm an ethnic mix of several different things, but the two parts that really kind of thrive on the alcoholism are the Irish and Comanche parts. And so usually I'm going to have some kind of an entertaining evening when I'm drinking. It's not going to be just a ho-hum, stand at the bar and do nothing evening. And I like the Irish part because I was really spun up on all that Irish music and the freedom songs and rebel songs and drinking songs. And I had access to a lot of those places as I flew around the country. I knew where they were, those live Irish authentic bands. And I would go to these places, and I'd be there until the band quit, and I was the last one out the door. Loved that stuff. And then, but you could never tell what was going to happen. Maybe the mood was different. I don't know. Maybe the planets weren't aligned quite right. And the other side might kick in, and I'd think, you know, I think tonight I'll just have a couple of drinks and go out and kill some white people. And so you just never knew. You just never knew. I grew up in the native culture. I was a dancer in the powwows, and I was I learned the songs and the traditions, and that was a very important part of my identity. And it was one of the things that I shamed, of course, that night in Fargo. You know, I wasn't supposed to do that. I had been brought up to always do my best, no matter what it was. I mentioned that my folks died from alcoholism, but I never go to the podium without thanking my parents because they gave me some good stuff before the alcohol killed them. They weren't drunk all the time. And they taught my sister and I some good stuff and gave us some good stuff, and I'm in their debt for that. And I always acknowledge that from the podium. When I was 14... the alcoholism had really reached its peak inside the family. The family completely imploded, and my parents divorced. And neither my sister nor myself saw that coming, and it really impacted both of us. Within the next 3 years or so, each of them had been married and divorced two more times, and I didn't get along with stepbrothers and stepsisters and stepparents, and I would have some kind of clash or conflict and be asked to go to the other family, and I'd go over there for a while until something occurred there, and then I'd bounce back. Names changed, faces changed, and I don't remember any of those people. Wouldn't know them if they walked into the room. I graduated when I was 17. My sister and I were really on our own, and nobody was paying attention. And so I squandered a lot of academic opportunities that I could have had in high school. I graduated when I was 17, and most of the people there where I was from married their little high school sweethearts and went to work in the aircraft factories that Wichita was known for, Boeing, Beech, Cessna, and there were some more there at the time. And I wasn't interested in doing that. I was going to join the service, I thought. And about that time, one of my buddies came back from the Marine Corps and right out of boot camp, and he was smart and spiffy looking and sharp. And I sat with him for an hour or several hours in a bar one afternoon and listened to him regale me with all these boot camp stories about what Marine drill instructors do to their recruits, which is cruel and sadistic stuff. And I just hung on every word. And it was probably an early sign of some skewed thinking because I thought, I just can't wait to go do that. And I'm 18 by this time. I found a Marine recruiter. I sign on the line and off I go. There are two things that I hear an awful lot of from the speakers at the podium, neither one of which will apply to my story tonight. It's true for them. It's not true for me. And that is that I never fit in. I did. And the other thing is I took that first drink, the magic hit and struck, and I got taller, bigger. Your gal, your boobs got bigger, and all this stuff happened to you, and the magic was there, and you were off and running. That's not true for me either. I didn't like the taste of it, but I did like the effect. That was true all the way through. I think normal people like the effect, frankly. That's why they drink. But I saw some information not long ago that I really buy into and believe that alcoholics, like you and me, we like the effect 5 to 8 times more than the normal people next to us. You know, and I've heard, you know, I thought, well, normal people drink. They lift their inhibitions. They think they can dance better. But when I saw this information, I thought, man, that I believe that. 5 to 8 times greater. And I don't know when I'm drinking next to a normal drinker that they're not feeling exactly what I'm feeling and to the degree and the depth that I'm feeling it. So I really buy into that idea. I went into Marine boot camp. The other thing I'm not going to be able to do tonight in the interest of time is to go through a big, long drunkologue. I think it's important for identification purposes. I have to slow that down. I have to abbreviate that and just tell you that I drank like everybody I've ever heard drank, almost. I drank too much, too long. I had a lot of blackouts. I woke up in places I didn't know where I was or how I got there. I lost some cars. I got in fights. I had 2 DWIs when I was living in Minnesota. I was separated by about 5 or 6 years. I was convinced that was just bad luck, coincidence, could happen to anybody. That was my argument for a long time until I got into treatment. Those things can happen to anybody. It was a good argument, except when I listed them all out, I thought, no, all those things could happen to one person. And I got a good Indian buddy that says he was in court for his 6th DWI before he learned that did not stand for drinking with Indians. And see, I love our laughter. I love it that we can come here and laugh. That's a gal said to me, I commented about that. I wish I had captured it like she did. She said, I think our laughter is the sound of freedom. And I thought, that can't be said any better. Because we laugh in a whole healthy, healing way now. And I enjoy that. I think that's one of the great gifts that we get from this recovery thing. I settled into the Marine boot camp process. I didn't drink. My drinking took a while to really pull away from the crowd. I was always in a hard drinking environment. You know, this is a chronic progressive disease, and I know a lot about it because I get to hang out with a bunch of the doctors' workshops and some of the other stuff. And we don't all progress at the same rate, and I didn't. And it took a while before I began to pull away from the crowd, but eventually I did. I snapped into this boot camp process, and I really enjoyed it. I loved it. It was tough. It was intense. It was extreme. Very competitive, and only if you've been through Marine Corps boot camp do you really understand what I'm talking about. And that's not meant as an insult to the other services. It's just a fact. And as we completed the 13th week there, out of 70, there were three names called by the drill instructors, and of the three top guys, my name was the second name call. I couldn't believe it. I never expected something like that, and I had never achieved or accomplished anything, especially under those conditions. And so I got a PFC stripe. Now, that's one stripe. That's private first class. You cannot run the Marine Corps as a private first class. But that was a huge thing because I got 67 of my buddies that are still slick sleeve privates. And I can't take my eyes off of that red bordered stripe. Private first class prowess. Amazing. I was so proud. We went to Camp Pendleton. We immediately drew guard duty. It was raining. My buddies are out in the walking post with rifles on their shoulders in the rain. But because of that stripe, I'm acting corporal of the guard inside a dry Quonset hut. And I looked across in the corner and I saw a utility uniform with a silver bar on a first lieutenant uniform. And I remember looking at that and sliding my chair back and thinking, this is where I belong. This is where I'm going to stay. And at the rate I'm going, general can't be that far away. So I stayed in the Marine Corps. That's all. And I fit in. I belonged. That was because I'd experienced that thing that the Marine Corps is famous for, that camaraderie, that sense of belonging, that tightness, that esprit de corps that still exists today, even though I've been gone a long time. It's still there. So I came walking in after 4.5 years. I was excelling, always excelling. I'm drinking hard. My buddies and I are drinking hard, but you can't pull me away from the crowd yet. And my commanding officer took me in and he said, there's a new program out called Marine Aviation Cadet. And he said, you've got extremely high entry scores, which I knew about. I don't know how they got there, but I knew they were there. And he said, you're the only guy in the unit who has an opportunity to go test for this new program called Marine Aviation Cadet. And I'd always wanted to fly, but I had never entertained that realistically. Because pilots, in my view, came from different sections of Wichita. They came from families that were not like mine. They didn't come out of Plainview. They didn't come out of a Native American segment. They didn't come out of an alcoholic home. And they weren't high school grads. They had college. But I wanted to test, and I went over and test, and I passed. It was an all-day thing. Commanding officer then told me, he said, this is an 18-month program, very highly paced. And he said, you're one of a very few who are coming in the back door as an enlisted Marine taking a test. 98-99% of the other people coming in from the civilian street side have to have 2 years college just to get in the door. And roughly 50% don't make it. And I knew that my chances were really diminished as a result of my high school education, that based on the competition I was going to have. But I wanted to fly, and I said, I want to go. I want to try. I went back to Wichita the day before I was going to Pensacola. They had a powwow. I went out and danced. My friends came out, and my family called, the Kiowa family called for a special for me. It was an honoring dance because I was leaving the next day. And that's all I could think about for the next 18 months was that dance, that honoring dance, and the fact that I could not go back to that Native community with my tail between my legs telling them that I'm back because I didn't make it. I couldn't hack it. I'm back early. I cannot do that because I'm the only one getting that opportunity. And I was driven with that for 18 months. There were four phases of flight training. And in every one of those, I was the number two guy. I never got cocky, never got complacent, never thought I was doing as good as my grades indicated. And I was watching my friends wash out constantly. And I thought one of these days, every time I saw one of them say goodbye to me and walk away with a sea bag over his shoulder, I thought someday before this is over, that will be me. But I kept pushing ahead hard. Now, I'm drinking hard. Friday nights and Saturday nights, I'm drunk every time. As a matter of fact, as I stand here right now, I can't remember very many times, if any, that I drank that I wasn't drunk. That's why I drink. I drink to get drunk. I know that if that was true, I would be dead. I wouldn't be standing here right now. But that's my memory. That's my recollection. And so every Friday night, Saturday night through flight training, and this is well before Vietnam, we were out there just tearing it up. I mean, we were just going as fast as we could. But on Sundays, I didn't drink because I had something I wanted. I wanted these wings. I wanted these wings. And the big book talks about how at some point in time we could control our drinking, and I was at that point. There was something more important than the booze. So Sundays I was studying, gearing up, and getting ready to go on Monday. Final 6 months, I left Florida, and I went to Texas for advanced jet flight training. Got in there on a Friday night, August of 62. Got hooked up with all my buddies. We got drunk. They said, let's go into town. That's where we got a bunch of good-looking South Texas girls in there. And we got an inside track because we're going to be pilots and officers, and they knew the place. And we went in there, a place called Canes. They immediately went after four girls in this car, and I stood back and drank a little bit more because I was never that gutsy or aggressive. And I thought, I'll have a few more, and then I'll make my approach. And I was watching the driver. Couldn't see her very well, but I was standing back there rehearsing a whole bunch of things that I thought I could say and get away with. And, well, they were cool. And so I walk up there. And I'm thinking, I've got these things going on. I bet she may just take her clothes off sitting there. I walked up and she looked at me and everything just left. I was just empty. I'm standing there completely awkward and empty, and she's got this look on her face. And I said, she had these eyes. And I said, you got the prettiest brown eyes I've ever seen, except it didn't come out right. I had a logic drink. It came out. I said, oh, she's got brown eyes. She looked at me like I just peed on the side of her car, and I turned around and walked away. And I was embarrassed. And I thought, there's something really cruel about that. I've been drunk many times when I couldn't talk, but most of the time I didn't know I couldn't talk. Now, a few times I knew I couldn't talk, and I would just call it quits. But I thought, you know, when you're that drunk, you should be so far past the ability to be embarrassed. And I was embarrassed on top of it. So I walked back, and I wasn't going up anymore. And a little while later, she got out and went into the ladies' room, and I got a good look at her. And she looked good. She had turquoise shorts on, cute little butt and pretty legs. And I'm thinking, my God, I had an A thought, didn't know it was an A thought. I recognized it 29 years later when I heard it again. But I thought, you know, I really want what she has, and I'm willing to go to any length to get it. and I did. I had a chance encounter with her the next day, bought her some coffee. I was nervous, but I was sober. She told me her name was Barbara, and we began to date. And on February the 25th, 1963, on her 20th birthday, she pinned these wings right above my heart and pinned two gold bars on me, on my shoulders. I had made a big transition from a Marine private to now a commissioned Marine Corps officer, second lieutenant fighter pilot, and I had done it. I could go home. I could go back now. Barbara joined me out in California. She was the youngest wife out there. We had gone back to Wichita for 3 weeks' leave. It was coming to an end. She was staying with my sister, and I called her and said, I don't want to lose you. Let's run down to Oklahoma and get married. So we jumped in the car, found a justice of peace at Newkirk, Oklahoma, and got married. And this past March the 9th, we just celebrated 51 years. So that's... She was the youngest wife in the squadron, and she was immediately pregnant, which I thought was part of my duty as a Marine. We had this little boy, and 8 days less than a year later, we had another little boy, and I used to get really irritated at people coming up and going, are you guys Catholic? And I go, no, we're horny Protestants. And we were one of the first jet units to go into Vietnam, and Barbara went home with these two little babies, went to a place called Chu Lai, 50 miles south of Da Nang, very primitive, typical Marine Corps operations, sand, tents, sea rations in little teeny cans, no air conditioning, no ice cubes, no cold water, no nothing. Just World War II. I thought, this is just like John Wayne movies that I've seen, except it's in color. And we were flying off a little abbreviated landing strip, combat airstrip. All of our returns and landings were carrier landings. We were all carrier qualified. Jet assist takeoffs. We flew some extremely complex combat missions, and we acquitted ourselves incredibly well, incredibly well. I look back on that, and those are some of the finest days I'll ever experience with 28 of the best pilots. It'll ever be my honor and privilege to be with those guys, and I'll never experience that again. While I was there, I got a regular commission, which I knew they would never give it to a a Marine with no college, a high school diploma. They were very competitive, and I got a regular commission. So that's what I'm expected to do. That's what I expect of me, and that's what other people expect of me. I came back, and I stayed in for about another 2.5 years, and then went to work at Northwest Airlines 3 weeks after I got out. I got into the Marine Corps 11.5 years earlier as a barely 18-year-old kid right out of high school. I came out as a mature senior, well-decorated Marine Corps captain, combat veteran from Vietnam. For nearly 22 years at Northwest, I had the same kind of ride. I loved what I did. I loved the people I worked with. Barb and I talked about adopting a little child, and even before we got married, and we put in and adopted a little girl, which was a struggle because we already had the two boys, and we put in a big fight for her. Adopted this little Indian girl who came home to live with us when she was 17 days old. She became the center of my universe. My little daughter was everything to me. And when she was 17, I thought everything was great. Perfect family, perfect neighborhood, perfect career, perfect everything. My drinking was picking up. All along the way, my drinking was picking up. Still not really, really noticeable. And I'm not having any consequences. I'm not having it. Had some car accidents, no big deal. One car accident, I wrote them off, brushed them off. You know, nothing happened. And I put off being a captain for 2 years until Dawn was getting ready to leave home and go to college, I thought. As she was coming up on graduation, I went to Chicago to take a special written test, and on that afternoon, she ran away. I didn't see it coming. Barbara didn't see it coming. I called home the next day, and Barbara informed me what had happened, and I panicked. My little girl was gone, and I told Barbara where to go and who to call, where to look, and I got on the airplane. 2 hours later, I was back in Atlanta, but something somehow on that airplane had changed, and I don't know what, where, how, or why. I don't remember feeling anything, but I got off the airplane and I hated her. God, I can't tell you how much I hated her. It was white hot. And I told Barbara, I said, I don't care if she dies in the streets. She'll never come back to my home. And I never want her name mentioned again, ever in my presence. And Barbara said, and the rest of the family was told this. And I went to the bank and I ripped up her adoption papers. I went to an attorney and disowned her. I tried to annul the adoption, and I couldn't. And in the midst of this tornadic activity, within 2 days, everything she'd ever owned or touched in my house was gone. There was no trace, no evidence she'd ever been there. And in the midst of all of this, as I look around and I assess things, I don't think Barbara's handling this too well. She probably needs a therapist. So I get in the yellow pages, and by the luck of the draw, I get this PhD family therapist who was, in fact, a very good therapist. And we saw him for 2 years, about twice a month. And one time he was trying to get me to talk about my daughter, and I made a statement that absolutely painted me. Something I'd never remember formed or fashioned in my... I don't remember the thought ever occurring to me. But as he said something to me, I looked at him. I said, I'm going to tell you something, doctor. I said, I would rather hate than hurt. And that's what I did. He said, you survived a childhood doing it, and if you continue, it'll destroy you. Everything he told us was true. It just took some time to prove out. That's what I've always done, though. I don't like pain. So rather than allow myself to get hurt, I'll get angry. And if I get angry, I get angry fast enough, quick enough. I don't feel that pain. It blocks it. And that, I spent a lifetime doing that. And Barbara suffered as a result of that. That was one of the amends I had to make. My drinking really escalated at that point. I'm not an alcoholic because Dawn ran away, but my acceleration really picked up at this point. The problem was the alcohol quit working. Barbara said, I don't want you drinking at home because of the things you say about Dawn when you're drinking. And I understood that. I said, I'll just drink on the layover. So I knew exactly where to go and how long it took me to change clothes, get back to my room with a quart of boots. And I turned the TV on. I wouldn't answer the phone. If a crew member called, I wouldn't go to the door if they knocked. And I would guzzle that quart of booze. And I mix drinks strong. And the first time, it's not uncommon for me to have to gag and choke to get that first one down because it's strong. It's stiff. But once I get that first one down, the rest of them slide down really good. But I could never achieve that peace that booze has always brought me, that warm glow, that letting go, that relaxed feeling that I don't care what was going on 5 minutes ago. It's all okay. I'll deal with it later. It's all right. I never got that again, ever. And I chased it over and over and over. What happened for me was when I poured the booze down, I might as well have been pouring gas on a fire. because up came the hatred, the bitterness, the self-pity, the martyrdom, this list of things I had done for her for 17 years, and this was the way I got repaid. And by the time the bottle was empty, I was emotionally exhausted. And yet, the very next night, in a different town, in a different place, a different liquor store, I would do it all over again. Over and over and over I did that. And that's where we were pretty much when the arrest took place. I went into the treatment center. I didn't want anybody to know who I was. It was a week before anybody knew the color of my eyes. My head was always down. I couldn't look at anybody. I wouldn't look at anybody. Day two, the news breaks, and now everybody knows. Everybody knows. A week to the day that I entered treatment, they announced on TV, I wouldn't go near the TVs. The patients would come report. And they announced, Northwest announced that I'd been terminated as I should have been. The FAA had issued an emergency revocation of all my certificates. That was fair. And I'd lost my FAA medical because of my alcoholism. So I'm stripped of everything. Stripped of everything that I'll ever need. It's all gone. And it was all fair and appropriate. I think, in my view, that the single greatest tragedy of this disease is not what happens to me. I deserve it. I can handle it. What the tragedy is that I bring all of this to my wife and my kids, my friends, my family. Everybody who cares anything at all about me gets to share in the suffering that I bring. That's the tragedy, as I see it, with alcoholism. Innocent people suffer. I walked into a room for a group therapy somewhere in that first week, not intending to talk or not to talk. They closed the door, and there were 8 or 10 of us in there, and for some unknown reason, I started to talk about my daughter. And that wall of anger was no longer there. And I broke down and cried. I didn't cry at my parents' funerals. And I don't know if it was a male thing, a Marine thing, a Comanche thing. I don't know. My sister said to me in an email a couple of years ago, she said, I grew up with you. I didn't think anything would ever make you cry. And I cried. And I was ashamed and I was embarrassed. But it was one of the greatest breakthrough moments I had in treatment. Because I started to learn to feel again. It hasn't got anything to do with how tough I am. I told Barbara, I said, look, let's get a hold of Dawn. Let's put the family back together again. This treatment center had no visitors, no phone calls. They said, that's such an incredible breakthrough for you. We'll give you a day room if you can make it happen. A few days later, Barbara knew where Dawn was. The two doctors heard about this and said, could we please come watch? And they were there in that room. As I walked into the day room, I looked at my little girl, and she was so much smaller than I remembered. I hadn't seen her for 2 years. My two sons were there. Barbara was there. I walked over and I put my arms around my little girl and told her how much I loved her. Said how much I hated her. In her arms was a 5-month-old granddaughter I didn't really know anything about. My daughter's last name was new to me. She'd gotten married and I didn't know. We healed that relationship. She's had a lot of struggles since that time. She's in a struggle right now. But I have not alcohol or drug related that I'm aware of. But I have a program called Alcoholics Anonymous that allows me to allow her to live her life. She has a journey, just as I have one, and just as you have yours. And my job is not to live hers, but simply to be her dad, and when she calls home, be able to say, I love you. And that's exactly where we're at. The promises were already starting to come true, and I didn't even recognize it at that time. I did tell them, you need to gear up, because you're going to see your dad handcuffed and led away on TV. We're certainly getting messages about legal stuff, none of which was known at the day of the arrest. Minnesota and North Dakota are both getting involved in it. And finally, I go through 6 of these crises, 2 to 3 days apart. And every time they take me out of a group, it's like I can't breathe. My heart stops. Like there's no air in the room anymore. And every one of these escalating events is worse and worse and worse and worse. The 6th time I step outside, and there's a doctor, and we go down to his office. And he says, I have to tell you, my counselor's there. And he said, I have to tell you, a federal grand jury is now involved. They've just indicted you. You're looking at 15 years federal prison, $250,000 fine, and an attorney's coming in Sunday and wants $50,000. We went broke the first 30 days. I didn't have it. And he said, are you going to hurt yourself? And I said, no. I went back to my room, and I don't remember collapsing, but I was on the floor, on the carpet, crying for the 2nd time, and I said, God, I can't do this anymore. I've got nothing left. I can't do this even one more time. Please, please help me. And I slept that night. I'm starting to look at legal consequences. The only time I thought I would ever be locked up was as a POW in Vietnam if I was shot down. And now it's all coming really big time. I had many, many experiences in treatment, life-changing experiences, because I went there not with the idea of resisting or arguing or debating, hoping that this thing worked. I didn't know if it would work once I left the treatment center. I didn't know if the things that I was reading in the big book could be translated to the outside world and reality. But I hoped. God, I hoped. And I'm here tonight to tell you that they're all true. Those promises are all true. I left the treatment center, and I went up and was in a very heavily publicized three-week trial in Minneapolis. There was no place I could go without the reporters sticking cameras and microphones in my face. I had a story with an attorney I'd love to share, but can't in the interest of time. I told him, I said, I'll be found guilty, and when I am, I'll be okay. I had an edge up on the other two guys because I was the alcoholic, and I'm in meetings up there at night. When I'm not in the courtroom, I'm in an AA meeting. And that's where I belong. And I flinched at first because everybody recognized me because of all the TV coverage. And I never shared, but I would sit in your midst and I would listen to you share and I would take that energy back to the courtroom the next day. A criminal trial, especially one that's highly publicized, is just indescribable. There are no words to define it. And I'm being painted as the worst person on the face of the planet. The media's picking it up. The tabloids are picking it up. And there were times I would look, and I couldn't do anything about it. And I would look across the courtroom, Barbara's eyes would meet mine, and she would mouth the words, I love you. And I'd nod, and I'd be okay. We did the trial one day at a time, just like I'd done everything else. The jury went out, the jury came back, we showed up. I'm the captain, everything comes to me first. Guilty, I saw my attorney stiffen, I reached over and patted him, I said, it's okay. It's okay, Peter. It's all right. We went back for the sentencing. Guidelines were in place at that time. They no longer are, but it was 12 months to 18 months. I was the captain. I knew I was going to get 18 months. Except for a day and a half before the sentencing, my attorney calls me. He said, I have bad news. He always had bad news. We never got any good news. I never got any good news. He said, the judge has just notified the other two attorneys and the media that he's going to depart upward from the sentencing guidelines. I'd watched this judge for 3 weeks, and he had strong feelings about this case, and he was entitled to all of them. He was absolutely justified in feeling that. And so I knew this was going to be something big. And I told Barbara, step one all over again. I'm powerless. It's all about acceptance. I can't change anything. I was in treatment with a federal judge. He said, you need to know that the sentencing is a charade. He said, you're going to come through. He said, when we come through that door, he said, the sentence is set no matter what you say, what your witnesses say, or what your attorney says. And judges around the country and other attorneys have told me that is so, that it doesn't change. And I knew that. The other two didn't. My turn came to stand up and speak, and I was so scared I didn't know what I was going to say. But my prayer was just, let me say something from the heart. I talked about being grateful for the things that happened in my family. I was grateful to be sober. I had accepted responsibility for this from day one, and I couldn't change anything that had happened. But I stood accepting full responsibility. The judge announced a sentence on me of 16 months, 2 months less under the guidelines, blew everybody away in the courtroom. Later, he told my attorney I was going to sentence him to 4 years until I heard him, and I looked at him, and I thought more about him as a human being. So a miracle took place in the courtroom that morning. I didn't know how it had happened, but I knew something had occurred. He also told he said, this is a complex case not designed for pilots. The law was not designed for pilots. There'll be appeals. I'll let you stay free until your appeals are exhausted. The other two said they would. I said, I will not. I'll go to prison now because I've been convicted. Because I learned in here that I deal with life on life's terms, not mine. And staying out of prison for another year and whistling in the dark wasn't going to get it for me. So on December the 5th of 1990, 34 years to the day, that I entered Marine boot camp, I checked into the Atlanta Federal Prison System out here as inmate 04478-041. I spent 424 days in the prison system. I had many, many experiences, none of which I talk about from the podium, because they have nothing to do with my recovery. But I can guarantee you that my recovery and everything that I had learned and all the steps that I used, all of which I've always used since I got sober, had everything to do with how I dealt with prison, the people in it, the situation, circumstances, and experiences. I had a guy come up to me one time after I'd spoken. He said, 424 days? He said, shh. He said, that's nothing. He said, I was out there 18 years. I just looked at him grinning. I said, well, you win. And that was a long time for me. I came out of there broke. The judge put sanctions on me, make sure I never, ever saw the inside of a cockpit again, ever, that were even worse than what the FAA had done. And I would never fly again. About a year later, he lifted those sanctions. The FAA said, if you want to fly again, you'll start all over again with a private license, which I had never had. And I didn't think I could do it. None of my pilot buddies thought that was doable, to go back and get four licenses, literally, from the ground up. But I bounce back to the program here. There's a lot of I and me in this story. It's not about I or me. It's a first-person story, so I say I or me. Everything that I have done and still do today comes from my recovery, from treatment, from the AA 12 steps, from everything that I use. This is how I survive. And I thought, well, I'll do the licenses in the same way I stay sober, one day at a time, one license at a time. 10.5 months later, I'd pass the writtens on all four licenses. Hard, hard work. No shortcuts. But there's a flying part that goes with that, and I couldn't do that because I'm working back at the treatment center now in the counseling department. I'm making $14,000 a year, and it's one of the best jobs I've ever had, but I'm just barely staying alive. I can't do the flying. It's going to cost $10,000 to $20,000. About that time, one of the pilots from Northwest gets a hold of me and said, you didn't know it, but I got a flight school. I want you to come up here and live with me and go through my flight school. So I went up there and lived with him and his family, checked in with the Minnesota Department of Corrections. I'm under 13 conditions of probation. I spent 44 days up there. Rained out 14 days. I flew the remaining 30. I flew 78 hours and 30 days, and that's a lot. I got two licenses back by one. I had about two of them by 11:15 one morning. I don't think that's ever been done before. I'm in AA meetings up there. When I'm not flying at night, I'm in AA meetings because that's where I belong. That's where I live. That's how I survive. I left there and I had four licenses in my pocket. But I thought, that's great, but nobody will fly. Nobody's going to hire me. Everybody knows about Lyle Prowse and Northwest Flight 650. I'll never fly on American soil. A month later, those licenses physically arrived in the mail, and I got a phone call an hour later from the head of the pilot union at Northwest. I'd never activated the grievance that had been filed because I knew they were justified in terminating me and I was not going to fight it. He said, this is the best phone call I've ever made because he said 3 hours ago, John Dasburg, president and CEO of Northwest Airlines, made a personal decision to bring you back to the airline and put you in full flight status once more. I sat there with tears streaming down my cheeks. I could not believe that after the horror and the shame and the embarrassment that I had brought to Northwest Airlines, they were going to let me fly again. And then when I pondered it a little bit more, I thought, he's betting his career on mine. If I relapse, after all my publicity, after alcoholic in the headlines, the board of directors will boot him off and he'll never find another place in aviation. Why would he take this kind of a chance? And the answer is, I don't know even to this day. I went back and signed a very emotional back-to-work agreement with a lot of people attending. Never to be a captain again. I said, that's okay. At least now I'm going to get part of a retirement. That had been a big knife in my heart that I had taken Barbara after Vietnam, after all the struggles and difficulties. I had taken her to the end of a road with a zero on it. And now at least I was going to be able to at least provide a little bit for her. I went back, and my dedication was to be the best employee they ever had. I was certainly the most visible. They now had a program for pilots, and I was part of it. And I never wanted John Dasburg ever, from the moment I came back to the time I retired, to have an ounce of regret about ever bringing me back to work. And I strove hard for that, and I did a good job, and I know I did. But the miracles never cease. If we stay sober, the miracles just keep coming. And I was speaking at United Airlines coming up on my last year. I get a phone call late at night, same pilot. No longer head of the union, but he said, John Dasburg knows you're coming up on your last year, and when you come back, he has changed your agreement, and he thinks you need to be a 747 captain. I went back, and I checked out in the left seat of the 747. For the last year, I flew a mega-million-dollar airplane all over the world, fully, totally, absolutely trusted, because I am a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not because I'm anybody special. I have no gifts that you don't have. I don't have anything going for me that you don't have. I just stay sober one day at a time. I retired honorably at the age of 60 in 98. And I knew I had done a good job. I had a better reputation then than I'd ever had before. Within a couple of days, my attorney calls me. He said, I just got a phone call from Judge Rosenbaum 8 years after the trial. Toughest judge in the Minnesota Federal District is now Chief Judge. He said in 16 years he's never supported a petition for pardon. But he said he'll support yours if you want to make the attempt. I had never considered such a thing. The judge wrote a 3-page affidavit that is so chokingly powerful that I still to this day cannot read all 3 pages without getting tears in my eyes. That went in, the paperwork went in. 2 years later, I came in and 8 phone messages telling me I had just received a presidential pardon. That's mega huge if you're a federal felon. I remember the second day in treatment, which was a Saturday, and I sat there and I listened to him read the promises as they did here tonight. And I perked up a little bit until they got to that part that says, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, I thought that I'm out. That's out. Maybe I'm going to get sober, but I'll never see the promises. And I'm telling you, as I stand here right now going over time and trying to finish this up, you have not heard 70% of the entire story. There are just too many miracles, and I've done what I could to just hit on some of them. Let me close with something I heard Father Martin do one time. And I love this because I think it speaks to life as I understand it. I got to spend time with him several times, a number of times. But I like this because it's my way of looking at life. And that is, I do not wish you joys without a sorrow, nor endless day without the healing dark, nor brilliant sun without the restful shadow, nor tides that never turn against your bark. I wish you faith and strength and love and wisdom and goods, gold enough to help some needy one. I wish you songs, but also blessed silence, and God's sweet peace when every day is done. My Comanche name is Yetzitanapa. You know me as Lyle, and I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for being here this evening. Thanks for the happy landings, Lyle. Tinsley, please come up. Tinsley Eady will give out the chips.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you so much, Lyle. Your story never gets old, and it's very satisfying. It's the opposite of drinking. Anyway, here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you're new and you'd like to try this way of life one day at a time, we offer a white chip. Would anybody like to pick up a white chip?
down it's been walking for. Till that hill got flat and down, I won't have to fight it no more. Somehow, someway, I'll win my fight someday, and we'll all be together on that broad highway. And we'll all be together on that broad highway. And we'll all be together on that broad highway.